Right. Welcome to the Daily Friend Show. This is not Nicholas Lorimer. You would have guessed by virtue of being a bit slimmer and less hirsute. This is, in fact, me, Sarah Gonne, and I am female, although you might think that with the fluidity of your gender preferences, that may be open to question today as well. So I'll leave that up to you to think about. I'd like to welcome my guests who are familiar faces to you. Marius Roet, welcome.
Hi, Sarah.
Our correspondent in London for the time being. And Gabriel Krause, Gabriel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you very much. I will be changing my gender at least three times during the show, and bonus points to anyone who can figure out when it is.
Exactly. Ah, that's the point. You see, it's all in your hands, so to speak. Right, let's look at our first story, which let's call it a never-ending story, and it's Eskom. And specifically, it's Eskom and the strike at Eskom. And this is a very, very difficult situation and has partly resulted in the stage four load shedding that we are experiencing at present. Now, there's wage negotiations going on at Eskom, and you might wonder why they are anything to negotiate over wages, but be that as it may. And as a result, groups of strikers from some of the unions, sorry, groups of employees rather from some of the unions have gone on strike. The problem is that Eskom is an essential service, and essential services are not allowed to strike. They have to have their disputes over wages ultimately decided by the by either between them, the parties themselves, or by the CCMA at arbitration, ultimately, if all other processes fail. And with this has come the what usually goes with unlawful strikes, and that is violence, it's intimidation, it's preventing people from going to work. And that's part of the problem, is by preventing people who are going in to make up for the work that the strikers would have done, that extra staff has not been able to get in. So it's really become a crisis of enormous proportions. I made a suggestion that I might be seem a bit extreme earlier amongst colleagues today, and that was to suggest that maybe we declare this a state of emergency and call the army in. Morris, how do you feel about it? Do you have an alternative suggestion?
Well, not being in South Africa at the moment, I have not been affected by the load shedding, and it's been quite nice to have
So you
electricity
don't
quickly
care.
buzzed. No, but obviously it's as I said, it's an essential service, and it's basically sabotage what's happening. I mean, I saw on social media some people are saying they're not getting electricity for 7 hours at a time, and I don't know. I mean, it's obviously it has major knock-on effects for the economy. For whether people are working from home or in their offices, whatever the case is, and obviously people can get generators or get solar to run their businesses or whatever, but that's obviously extra costs which are then passed on to consumer, and it's just it's knock-on effects through the whole economy. And it's also, I mean, it's nobody's saying that people shouldn't be allowed to lobby for higher wages and so on, but if you are working for something like Eskom, which is an essential service, as you say, it's there should be better ways of doing this than going on strike and basically holding the entire economy or the entire country to ransom. It's not ideal. And as far as I know, power stations also national key points, so they
That
should be.
exactly.
So they should be. I mean, they're not just. I mean, people who work for Eskom aren't actually ordinary workers. They have a, without electricity, the economy simply can't function. And that's also why we need to, get independent power producers. Get more of them online, and there does seem to be quite a lot of movement on that. We know that I saw recently Andre de Ruyter said they a whole bunch of they've just signed contracts to a whole bunch of independent power producers that are going to use land that belongs to Eskom to produce electricity. The details escaped me, but I think it was might have been renewables. But I mean, that's besides the point. As long as there's extra power coming into the grid, so there does seem to be a small light at the end of the tunnel, but I mean, I'm not sure if that's actually a light, or if it's the train of, the train of impending economic doom, partly because of the Eskom's failures coming towards South Africans.
You make the point about it being national key points, etc., but you're also dealing with workers who relatively well paid. They're asking for, they started off, I think, at 15%, and they've gone down to 10 and 8%, while Eskom itself is offering 5.3%. Solidarity's asking, I think, 5.8 or 5.5. So they're very, very close. But not only are they relatively well paid, but they remained employed during COVID. So they continue to get their salaries during COVID, irrespective of what may or may not be happening outside in the rest of the world. Gabriel, do they still deserve any sympathy from our point of view?
It's hard to find anything but the most profoundly spiritual reasons to sympathize with people that have put a gun to the country's head, effectively, and said, give us an above inflation wage increase that is not matched by additional value add, or else. I think that it's worth recalling, even in the late 20-teens, one of the Eskom chairmen's, Chairman Mabuza, said that it was effectively at least 30% overstaffed. Mm-hmm. And that's because if you look over the last, since about 2008, Eskom hasn't really produced more electricity. The actual amount of electricity drawn from the grid has remained more or less the same, whereas the amount of staff has more than doubled. So it's like you need twice as many people to make the same amount of electricity. That doesn't really make sense.
It was essentially an employment agency exercise for the ANC.
Right. I think I once wrote a piece where I said, you know, you've got two kind of unemployment lines. And one of them is inside the building. You get a salary at the end of the week. You're not employed. You're not working. But you are getting a paycheck every month. And that's unfortunately what happened at various SOEs, various organs of state. I think that it's really deleterious. And I just want to say, you know, the economy breaking down, what does it mean? It's not just a little bit of inconvenience. If this keeps going, if I remember sort of internal briefings that I've seen properly, South Africa's capacity, the amount of electricity we actually put out is about half of the theoretical amount that we should be able to put out. Mm-hmm. So we're running at half capacity most days, two cylinders out of the four in this little engine. If you drop it any more, you don't have to drop it much more, about 10, maybe 20% more, you start getting to the point where widespread national breakdowns are possible. That's obviously why we are now undergoing 4 or 6 hours a day on average load shedding for most folks. We had 12 hours on Saturday, so maybe a foretaste of stage eight if that's to come. But if there is proper sabotage going together with these strikes and the blocking of people, then a total nationwide breakdown in a cold winter month could happen as we build up to the July 2021 anniversary of a profound breakdown in law and order in much of KZN and Gauteng. I think it's worth bearing that in mind. This is not something to play around with. This is not the way to bargain for higher wages. And really, it's hard to see how anything but an inflation matching wage increase could be justified. In fact, maybe a bit less to trim some of the fat. But that's maybe me being too harsh.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that sort of adds to the concern is that employees can be dismissed for unlawful striking ultimately. They can be dismissed for intimidating people or assaulting them or, you know, damaging property. The problem with Eskom is that if Eskom goes that route, they have a very real possibility that any dismissed employee, you'll see an uptick in sabotage. And so that's hence why partly I made the suggestion about getting the army in. Marius, any comment on that?
No, I think you've both covered it. But yeah, it's just, I think this poses a serious threat to South Africa. And I mean, Gabriel's right. I think people get very pissed off when they don't have electricity. And we've already seen people, you know, various protests in various areas because people aren't getting electricity. And yeah, it's just it's got so many other knock-on effects when the power producer isn't working. And the fact that Eskom basically has a monopoly also means that, you know, it's a very serious problem when Eskom itself isn't working. And yeah, it actually boggles my mind that this strike is happening and we're on stage 4 load shedding at the moment.
I think the problem is that I'm not even sure if it would help to, in the perverse sense of going to a complete blackout, you know, in other words, waking people up to the government up to the fact that something has to be done. But at this stage, it looks like we run the risk of doing it.
Can I say one thing before we move on, which is just on the idea of a state of disaster. I'm not sure of this, but my understanding is that maybe a strategic key point can already be defended by the army without having to declare a state of disaster. I think that's part of the idea of the special status that those positions hold. So if the strike continues and it continues to be violent, then I think getting South Africa's armed forces could theoretically be helpful to saving people from violence and intimidation who are just trying to keep the city's grid alive. The problem is whether it's possible to find the army and whether they can find the proper means
power stations.
And it really is a serious problem for this administration. I can't remember who wrote the line recently, but it's a good old line that I share and have shared for many years. Cyril Ramaphosa has this albatross of Marikana hanging around his neck. He's never made good on it. He's never moved past it in a good and proper way. He's deployed his compacting theory of if you don't talk about it too much and you look away, maybe it'll disappear. But as a result, we have a commander in chief, I suppose, who has proven last year to be way too slow on restoring law and order. It really is a big problem.
Yeah. I mean, even if the army were only to come in essentially to guard the perimeters and part of the inside of a power station area, it's not necessarily it may not necessarily be to protect people from other people and from prevent it from going to work. Now, an interesting issue, because the starts negative and possibly ends up a bit more positive, is that there's been quite a lot of discussion about the extent to which the government has talked about the ongoing likelihood of pension funds being targeted to fund state-owned enterprises. And a lot has been made of it in relation to the funding of the NHI, the National Health Insurance, which would be so eye-wateringly expensive that it is probably what will save us from the NHI. However, our Minister of Health, Dr. Joe Pachler, has said that he's highlighted the fact that the government remains committed to centralizing control and funds in its departments and in the hands of political appointees. That might be a bit of a dig at someone like Adrian Gore, who I think had an idea of being in charge of some of the administration of the NHI funds. But so that dashes the hopes of any private sector person from getting in on that act. Obviously, the fiscus currently is so strained that there is just no way it can provide the money for the NHI, certainly not in its entirety, and probably not even if it sort of gradually is implemented, which is what the Minister of Health has indicated. Now, essentially what will happen is private medical aids will be absorbed into the state, and their sole function will be to essentially provide and pay for what is not covered by the state. Now that in itself would put a lot of medical aids out of business despite anything else. So perhaps Solidarity has arrived on its white horse, and that it had a success in the North Gauteng High Court, where they declared sections 36 to 40 of the National Health Act unconstitutional, and it was awarded with costs. And I quote Dr. Dirk Herman, from the CEO of Solidarity. He says the government wants to change a system in which healthcare is nationalized and healthcare practitioners become servants of the state, so that the provision of a healthcare of all healthcare can be centrally controlled by the state. This victory thwarts those disastrous plans. Now, essentially, what sections 36 to 40 provide is that every healthcare practitioner has to obtain a certificate of need to practice in a specific area. And this has been around for a while. Now, what Solidarity argued was that the requirement for such a certificate infringes unlawfully on the right of health practitioners to practice their profession. In other words, those sections are unconstitutional. Gabriel, can I come to you? The import of this court victory.
I think it is a very serious victory. At the moment, the idea was just from the government, you can't build a new hospital or you can't open a new practice in an area unless you've done a survey to see if they're underserved. And if they're overserved already, you're not allowed to open your practice. We won't give you the certificate of need. So this sort of implies that the government can understand better from its perch in Pretoria where new practices need to open up than doctors themselves who are going about weighing off costs and benefits of starting here or starting there or moving here or moving there. That's absurd bureaucratic hubris, arrogance to think you can know better from far away. And we're used to that. So it's good that it was struck down. I think part of what's interesting is that the reason it was struck down was, as far as I can tell, grounded in your freedom to carry out your profession. There's a sort of professional protection contained in the Bill of Rights that you can't be impeded or hindered and you must be allowed to practice. So insofar as that argument knocks down the certificate of need, I think you'd need to put a few facts in a row. But where reality will bear you out, but I think you could successfully argue that the same right should protect doctors and nurses from the NHI. Mm-hmm. And that has long been one of the IRR's findings on the NHI proposals, is that a lot of doctors and nurses are sort of quite open about the fact that it would drive them out the country. And the same is, of course, true, but only more so for those that are still learning and are therefore more dynamic or can more easily move around because they haven't really gotten stuck in any particular venue yet. So you chase away a whole bunch of this generation's doctors and nurses, and you chase away a whole lot of future doctors and nurses. Yeah. And what you've done is you've made South Africa unlivable for anyone who can afford a plane ticket and a large enough shipping container to bring across their favorite treasures. Chase away the middle class and the country's toast. So it really is a bad idea. And the essence of that bad idea is not letting doctors and nurses pave their own way, cut their own eyes. So the same argument seems like it should apply in both cases. I don't think that means we're out of the woods yet. Mm-hmm. I think there is enough of a gap between the two that you could see this as a victory that gets overturned, maybe upheld at the SEA, but if it goes straight to the Concord, who knows what the Concord will do.
Exactly.
And if it gets overturned, it could go the other way. And that's why fighting the NHI and the Court of Public Opinion remains very important.
In fact, with younger doctors, the Department of Health is just going the extra mile to encourage them to leave the country, and that is they're not placing them in community positions, which they have to do in order to qualify as fully fledged doctors. I think that the last excuse was that they didn't have the money to pay them. I suspect it probably has more to do the quality of administrative skills in the Department of Health than anything else. Maurice, your take on both and all these arguments?
It still boggles my mind that we're still even thinking about the NHI. It's been shown South Africa simply can't afford it. And as you guys have pointed out already, we'll see an even greater exodus of skills from South Africa, obviously primarily medical skills. And I think a lot of people who aren't in the medical field but do have the means to leave will look to going abroad. And even in NHI in its current form, as far as I know, it's very few countries in the world have such a system where there's basically one provider of a single payer. Even in the rest of the world, in Western countries where there's universal healthcare, what have you, people still have options to join medical aids and to go private and so on. As with how the NHI is currently structured, I don't think that would even be an option. And Also, when it comes down to it, South Africa actually does have universal healthcare. Just often that, unfortunately, government facilities are often quite poor. But not even, but that's also not a blanket. You know, it's not across the board. There's still lots of government clinics and government hospitals that are still very good and provide decent healthcare. But it's very uneven the level of care you get, and we've seen horror stories of where babies are, you know, die because the nurses forget to feed them or whatever the case is. And there was a recent case now with that whistleblower. I think he was in Gauteng, the doctor who
Dr.
came
Tamaya.
Forward. Exactly, and he was suspended. So obviously there are issues, but so instead of destroying what works in South Africa, the government sector should be what should be fixed first. We should look at where things do work well in the government sector, then obviously copy that in the rest of the country. I believe the Western Cape's quite a good example of where government clinics and hospitals provide good services and what have you. So that's something we should look at. And even when the NHR was first being proposed, there were a couple of, they looked at a couple of clinics as pilot projects and so on. I believe only one of them actually met the NHR's own criteria to actually meet the minimum standards out of how many was 20 hospitals or whatever it was. So even government clinics themselves don't meet the what would be NHR standards. So it's actually mind-boggling that they want to get rid of what does work in South Africa. And as, I mean, to repeat it again, we'll see such an exodus of medical professionals and others, and anybody with many people with the means to leave will do so. And yeah, it's, we simply don't have the money for NHR, even though you could maybe make an argument for, you know, that it would work and, you know, you don't want to exclude certain, you don't want to exclude people. I mean, I don't think that's a very valid argument myself, but there simply isn't the money for it, and it won't work, and it's crazy that we're actually still thinking about doing it.
Well, as I recall, the standards required of the NHI for hospitals to be part of the system is probably being met by about 17% of hospitals across the country. So they would have to improve hospitals in order to qualify to be part of the system. And if they improve the hospitals, then they probably don't need, if they're capable of improving the hospitals, they don't need the system. This is how we roll in South Africa. I'd like to come to our last item, which we raised very, very briefly before the show started. And I'm going to ask Gabriel to lead us in on this, because he is acquainted with it. Gabriel, schools in Johannesburg and payment of water.
Hey, so yeah, so this is a tough one. A colleague of mine drew my attention to this report in Rapport newspaper yesterday. What was reported was that government and public schools, Model C schools and private schools, are all at the moment paying a greatly reduced property rates tax, and that this is going to be increased by a factor of 8 for the public and Model C schools and a factor of 10 for the private schools. Basically, the background is that one of the categories of property is a school, and has been for the longest time. And if you're a school, then you get a big discount on what your property rates are. That was then struck down at national level, but you could still apply to COGTA for exemptions. So at national level, in theory, they said, no, all of the schools must pay like as high a property rate as if they were businesses selling smut, pornography, rims for people to put in their cars and show off, you know, things that clearly don't have a third party positive social impact. You get charged as much taxes as them, but you can ask us for an exemption. Johannesburg was declined such an exemption. Wonder why. But then went ahead on its own plan of just keeping the school category in place. But that has now been scrapped. I think there was a sunset clause in the city of Johannesburg failed to put up a new workaround to keep the property rates low. Some of the examples that were given in the report had schools that were paying 40,000 rand a month, going up to being charged 400,000 rand a month in taxes. So if you're paying 5 million rand a year in taxes, rather than 500,000, that's 4.5 million that you've got to find somewhere. That could have been scholarship money, that could have been adding buildings, library, computers, all kinds of things, outreach programs. Instead, that's all got to go to the government, where it's going to spend it on let's look at the auditor's general reports to see what municipalities tend to spend money on. It's not great. I think it's an outrageous scandal. They had a headmaster of a school near the SABC in Auckland Park say that the school, if this doesn't get reversed pronto, is going to shut down. I don't know where those pupils are going to go. They spoke to another headmaster of a school further north that had similar comments to say. They also drew attention to the fact that Kuro, which is one of these large franchise schools like McDonald's for low-cost private schooling, where the budget is almost is less than a lot of Model C schools and about the in the slightly above the zone of the no-fee public schools. But the results are just day and night much better because the teachers show up every day, unlike in most public schools, and do their job and teach to the syllabus, and there you have it. They have been under legal challenge for the last 2 years. On the income side, they've been charged as if they were businesses rather than effectively something like an NGO. And again, the position there is that if they don't get a turnaround, it might drive the business out of business. And then all of those kids will have to fall back on the public schools that are so useless. Let me hit you with one last fun fact. We have 900,000 more pupils today than we did 20 years ago in South Africa's public schools. And we have 3,500 fewer public schools. So the pupils went up by 1 million and the schools went down by 3,500. It's completely backwards. The government is failing. We have the world's worst public education system on a bang for buck basis. 5% of grade ones pass matric in maths 12 years later. 80% of grade fours can't read. It's the worst in the world on the PRISM measure. We have just an awful, awful system. And the solution is to achieve equality by chopping down the tall poppies so that we have an equality of uselessness. And I think it's inhuman.
I was going to say that I think at last they've decided with Johannesburg how they're going to solve the education problem in this country. They're going to get rid of schools. Maurice, do you think there's a better way?
Yeah, I mean, this is apparently a statement. Abraham Lincoln apparently said it. He said, you can't strengthen the weak by weakening the strong. And I think that's exactly what happens in South African education system is always seems to be, I think the ANC itself is quite, they're quite suspicious of private schools and obviously even Afrikaans schools, if they public schools. So, yeah, again, same as with the NHR story. Instead of trying to replicate what doesn't work, we should look to what does work and copy what happens in schools that do work. And there are obviously also the public schools that work pretty well and give good results and people, you know, sets them up well for university or life after school. And we got to look and see what's being done well at those places. What's working? What's, you know, is it from the principal? Is it the surrounding community? Whatever the case is, probably a combination of all this kind of stuff. But that's what you got to look at. And yeah, it just seems to be another attack on number one, private sector, and on excellence, which does seem to be quite common in South Africa. But Panyaza Lesufi also recently won the ANC chairman position in Gauteng. So maybe he'll be moved out of the MEC for education position in Gauteng, which might be a good thing for education in the province. So we'll have to see.
From your lips to God's ears, Marius, but I somehow think that's not likely. I think our colleague John Kane Berman, in doing some research a couple of years ago, established that fundamental to the success of poor schools that really did well despite their lack of resources, was the principal, the person who pulled the school together and who pulled all the teachers together. Gabriel, in a minute, anything to add?
Yes, I just want to say that the IRR campaigns team has been campaigning against the Bella Bill for some time now, the Basic Education Law Amendment Bill. And our submission went to the committee, the parliamentary, to parliament, to say that this is a really bad idea. One of the things that Dr. Anthea Jeffrey warns about in the submission is that this can be used to try and achieve all kinds of employment equity targets, all kinds of racial demographic representativity to force admissions policies to change, to force schools. Partly, you know, Helen Duplessis, I see in the comments, said that there's a school close to her which has 40 pupils, and that's considered good. A part of the idea here is that you can take a school that's got 80 pupils and say to the one that's got 40, you have to change your admission policies so that you also get overcrowded. Because if all the schools are overcrowded, once again, we have a quality of uselessness. I was on a debate on Newsroom Africa last week for about an hour with a Stellenbosch professor.
I think Gabriel's been loaded.
I think somebody didn't want him to spill the beans. So I'm going to take the opportunity to end there. Please read us on dailyfriend.co.za. And if you want to find out more about the IRR, it's irr.org.za. So thank you very much for being with us. And maybe we'll be able to drag poor old Nick out of his sick bed tomorrow as is befitting. Keep well, keep warm, and I can't promise to ask you to keep the lights on.